I felt myself falling. And then I thought to myself, this sense of dread, this sense of fear taking over you, this sense of distress and disorientation, that's not how God wants you to live.
Welcome to Psalms for the Spirit, a podcast about spirituality and resilience through the lens of the biblical Psalms. I'm Kieran Young-Wimberly, a Presbyterian minister and spiritual director from the U.S., but living on the north coast of Ireland. I've been working closely with the Psalms for about a decade now, arranging, recording, performing Psalms set to Celtic melodies, along with my dear friends, the McGrath family from Dungannon, County Tyrone. And through the years, I've heard how the Psalms help people through times of trouble, through times when the mountains seem to be falling into the sea, times when the world is in upheaval, either on a personal level or on a collective level. In this podcast, I'm inviting friends and respected teachers to explore with me how the Psalms lift our spirits in difficult times, how they lead us toward healing and hope, and about the connection between spirituality and resilience. For our final episode of Season 2, today's guest is Rebecca Dudley, ordained minister and advisor with the New Zealand Red Cross, on legal frameworks protecting people in humanitarian emergencies. Rebecca spent many years in Northern Ireland devoted to human rights issues, and I know her from the Corrymeela community. I was so grateful that in the dark winter days, on this side of the world anyway, she offered a Zoom talk, which she entitled The Hope Project. In this talk, she shared her reflections on the poignant question, how do we pay attention without losing hope? I was so taken with her question and her findings, and of course I was drawn when she mentioned the Psalms as a part of her journey. I asked her if she would talk with me on this podcast about her Hope Project and its connection to the Psalms, which we were able to do just after Easter. Since then, as wave after wave of bad news rolls in, it's clear that her message is as timely as ever and essential for our well-being as we take in and respond to horrific news on a daily basis. In our conversation, we talk about the power of the Psalms to reach across time and culture, about images of hope as bridge and spark and lifeline, about how psychological first aid might support us in times of distress, and how the old spiritual traditions of vocation and intercession can help us find the small thing that is ours to do in this hurting world. If you'd like to hear Rebecca Dudley's original talk on the Hope Project, you'll find the link in the episode notes. I'd highly recommend it, especially if you resonate with this question of how we pay attention without losing hope. So whatever it is that brought you here, I'm glad you're with us.
You're the hope of the farthest oceans and the hope of the ends of earth. You redeem us from all our sorrows. You bring hope when a new day comes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Bright and early, your time.
Yeah. I'm in Wellington and The street is starting to wake up. There's a sushi place across the street, and sometimes the guys come and they bring the sushi and they blare the radio out to keep themselves working. So then further down the street, there's a recycling center and you hear all the bottles clamber in all at once. The sounds of the morning.
How is your spirit these days?
I think the answer for most days with a holding steady, holding mm-hmm. steady. Mm-hmm. And the physical feeling that I get when I say holding steady is the sort of feeling of steering a ship with one of those big wheels, and sometimes it's taking a fair bit of physical force and upper body strength to hold steady.
To hold steady. That's a really good image. Yeah. When you hold steady like that, it doesn't necessarily correct course right away. It's sort of you kind of imagine this like big ship moving, and, you know, it's not like, getting corrected immediately.
No, and it throws you around a little bit.
Mm-hmm. It's a very good image to start with. What's your background with the Psalms?
Yes, the first psalm that I remember is the psalm from which the words surely goodness and mercy come from, because my father Carl was married to my mother Shirley, and he used to call her Shirley goodness and mercy. And it took me many years, but eventually I connected that to Psalm 23. Uh-huh. But up until maybe I was 10 or so, I always thought that was my father's name for my mother, Shirley goodness and mercy. My father was a Presbyterian minister as well, and he used to say that we were created for community, and that always stuck with me, that we were created for community. And in about 1960, as a white Presbyterian minister, he was called to an historically African-American Presbyterian church in the Midwest of the U.S. And my mother was in the choir and my father was in the pulpit. And I remember very vividly being surrounded by quite stern church ladies during the service, you know. So my memory of the Psalms was in the sort of sometimes in very settings that would be familiar to all Presbyterians, of reading the Psalms, but sometimes in other settings and in gospel settings. I remember my Sunday school teacher, who was a fabulously rich-voiced alto, singing, "The Lord is my light and my salvation, whom shall I fear?" And of course, the way that most of us remember the Psalms is that we don't remember just the text of the Psalms. We don't remember, "The Lord is my light and my salvation, whom shall I fear?" We remember, "The Lord is my light and my salvation, whom shall I fear?" And then, "Whom shall I fear?" So we almost can't remember, or at least I find I can't remember the Psalms separate from the actual setting in mm-hmm. which they were sung or prayed. The other thing that came to mind when I was reflecting on this was that I have a very vivid memory of when I first got to seminary in New York City in 1987, having the privilege of taking a class with the Old Testament scholar Phyllis Tribble. Mm-hmm. And she had just at that point published Texts of Terror. But the abiding memory that I have of that Old Testament class was her love of, her absolute infectious love of the poetry and the forms of literature and the rhetorical criticisms that she brought to the sort of forms of communication in Hebrew scriptures. And I remember her saying that one of the kind of extraordinary aspects of the Psalms as poetry was that the poetic forms, and I know she enumerated several of them, but the one that I remember was repetition, that the poetic form of repetition was an ancient form of poetry that lost nothing in translation, because regardless of what language it was in, you could still get the poetry from the repetition, as an example of that form of poetry. Every time then in the last 35 years that I've come across the Psalms, I've kind of remembered that kind of lovely insight of that rhetorical criticism that Phyllis Trible shared with her Old Testament class, you know, in the mid-80s, that the Psalms just keep on giving because of these poetic and rhetorical forms that translate into every language and every time.
So those ancient poetic forms, they're communicable to other cultures and other times as well, and that there's something very long lasting about them.
They kind of manage to travel. They manage to travel across cultures and periods and peoples and ethnicities, and you know, they really have that rhythm that can speak to all of us.
By your strength you have formed the mountains, and you silence the stormy sea.
I work with the Red Cross, and of course at the moment I'm speaking in a personal capacity, but my work with the Red Cross, my day job, is that I work in international law, and I work on the kind of intersection between what the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement do internationally, which is on the one hand a principled humanitarian response, whether it's to conflict or whether it's to public health emergencies or whether it's to disasters. On the other hand, and this is kind of my area of work, I work on the international law issues that can protect vulnerable people in humanitarian emergencies. And so that means something called international humanitarian law, which is around the laws of armed conflict, that even wars have laws, and they are what are called the laws of last resort. They're about civilians being able to escape places of conflict. They're about getting humanitarian aid through in places of conflict. They're about kind of trying to maintain some kind of foothold again of humanity in a chaotic and horrific situation. Mm. Sometimes trying to get a humanitarian pause on which maybe other things can be built, trying to reduce suffering to people in war, but also to work with people who are made more vulnerable by disasters, and to try to address some of the ways that humanitarian emergencies can increase vulnerabilities and inequalities of people who are already quite vulnerable and situations, societies that they're already unequal. So on one end, there's response, the humanitarian response, and on the other hand, there's the law. So I do international law for those kinds of emergencies. And so that's the sort of day job, is dealing with, you know, all of the mess of all of those traumas, because by definition, that's really about trauma and multiple complex traumas.
I'd love it if you would explain to us about your whole project and what it was for you, how you came about it, and how you ended up living that out.
I think that the Hope Project starts many years ago, just for me. I mean, obviously for other people, Hope Projects have been going on for thousands of years. But for me, I got pulled into working for Christian Aid in the 1990s in the UK. And we worked together in terms of trying to face head on issues of activism and despair, really, in the face of the kind of enormity of the feeling of the world's problems. And at that time, of course, you know, increasing inequality and unpayable poor country debt, the sort of crushing burdens of increasing poverty for so many people, among, you know, other kind of intractable conflicts and other huge issues in the 90s. We might feel in retrospect like we didn't really have too much to deal with in the 90s compared to now, but certainly at the time it felt like plenty. And one of the insights that this research yielded was that quite often who don't respond to what's happening in the world, it's not that they don't care, it's that they feel paralyzed. And they feel that they can't move, and they feel overwhelmed, and the response is to turn inward. And the other insight that came from that research was that increasingly in the 90s and exponentially more so now, when people heard about what was happening in the world, it was often mediated through screens. And the effect of that is that you hear about this massive, great thing happening out there or through that screen. But when you hear about it, you're completely, usually, alone. Mm-hmm. And so the two insights of the sense of caring, but not knowing what to do and feeling like you couldn't do anything, and hearing about news in our millions, but each of us, when we hear about it, being completely alone, led us to work on trying to develop worship responses and resources that would help people feel and know that we're in a community, going back to that idea that we're created for community, that we can feel a sense of connection with other people, and that's actually one of the first steps to being able to respond, hopefully, to some of the things that feel so oppressive. So that's a kind of a long view into the initial work around how we could respond to the world in a way that was active and purposeful and went straight through despair to try to go out the other side into an active, purposeful sense of responding for this world that God loves so much, you know. And one of the kind of results of that work over time and reflecting on different things that happened over time was about 5 or 6 years ago, I did some work that I tried to pull together into practices of hope. That was called Activism, Despair, and the Practice of Hope. Hmm. And that was in 2016. And in 2021, I thought, you know, the world has done a few more revolutions.
A few things have happened.
A few things since then have happened. And I found myself feeling, particularly as I watched the news, some of the very distressing things that many of us kind of were watching, you know, tried to kind of make sense of it. I felt myself falling, you know, really kind of falling. And then I thought to myself, this sense of dread, this sense of fear taking over you, this sense of distress and disorientation, that's not how God wants you to live. You know, it's time to fight back somehow and try to regain some kind of solid footing. And I was interested to see, looking over the Psalms in the recent weeks, of, you know, having solid footing is one of the things that the psalmist really, really wants, is to have his feet or her feet on steady ground. And that's what I wanted. I wanted my feet on steady ground. I wanted to regain some footing. And so I thought, if I offer to sort of share some reflections with the Koinonia community, then that will, of course, require me to do some reflections that I can share. And so that was my Hope Project, and found it very helpful to me, and I hope to other people as well.
You're listening to Psalms for the Spirit, a podcast about spirituality and resilience through the lens of the biblical Psalms. We'll return to my conversation with Rebecca Dudley in just a moment. In this final episode of Season 2, I wanted to take a moment to let you know about a series of retreats I'll be leading at the beautiful Koinonia Residential Center in Ballycastle, Northern Ireland, in this coming year, in October, February, and May of 2022-23. We're getting word out about these retreats as early as we can so that you can mark your calendars, register, and book your travels well in advance. Spirituality and resilience is a theme that runs through all of my retreats. And we explore these connections through silence and sharing, prayer and reflection, music and art, solitude and community. If you would like to breathe a breath of fresh air in body and in spirit, come to Koinonia this year for one of our retreats. We would love to welcome you, and together we can seek out sources of healing and hope. You can go to koinonia.org for more information on how to book your place. In another piece of news, Celtic Psalms will be on tour in the U.S. for the first time since the pandemic. And we are so excited to be able to sing live again in so many communities in the Northeast U.S. this July. We are also releasing a fourth album of Psalms set to Celtic melodies very soon. See CelticPsalms.com for updates.
Details on all these happenings can be found on my website, kieranyoungwimberly.com, where you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter with a reflection from me and updates about what's coming up. Thank you for listening to Psalms for the Spirit this season. And once again, I'm so glad you're with us.
Any kind of real engagement with hope has got to start with actually paying attention to what's happening in the world. Because if you're not paying attention and you say it's easy to have hope, then yeah, you know, it's pretty empty, isn't it? It really doesn't mean very much to say that they have a lot of hope because they're not paying attention.
I think the way you put it was, if you find it easy to have hope, you're not paying attention.
Exactly. If you find it easy to have hope, you're not paying attention. So so that lifts our challenge then. And it's not just my challenge, obviously. It's all of our challenge if we're paying attention. That lifts the challenge to a whole nother level. How can you both pay attention and have hope?
Because it is so easy to, if you are paying attention, to be led into a place of despair, anxiety, fear, distress, disorientation, those words you were saying before.
All of those kinds of feelings. And of course, I think we have to acknowledge also that the pandemic has meant that we are in a historical moment that falls into the category of collective trauma. And that is a thing, you know, collective trauma is a thing, something that's been experienced in World War II, you know, where much of the world was swept up in conflict at the same time. And it's been, you know, obviously the pandemic of 1918 to 1920. And now this pandemic, and as I kind of got drawn into sort of looking at this idea of the fact that all of us, to some degree and in different ways, because of course, humanitarian emergencies and pandemics might affect everyone, but they don't affect everyone equally or the same. There's different impacts on the way that humanitarian emergencies affect different people, but we all are. There are people who are touched by loss of livelihoods. There are people who have lost loved ones. There are people whose health has been immediately affected, experiencing very close bereavements. There's people who are experiencing this sort of sense of dislocation of time and the sense of, you know, kind of losing our moorings somehow in terms of, you know, was that, you know, sort of 2 weeks ago or was that 5 months ago, or was that last year? You know, all of those kind of senses of disorientation are parts of some of the impacts of our collective traumas. So in terms of the Hope Project, I looked for ways to try to describe what hope could be. And one of the first insights came to me from an anthology of insights from people who had experienced mental ill health and were trying to help each other to sort of address their different challenges. And one of the contributions suggested that hope was a bridge, a gentle bridge. This is Jada Caesar, S-E-Z-E-R. And she's describing her own journey with mental ill health and hope. And she says, to me, hope is a gentle bridge between what is and what could be. And so I thought, oh, okay, hope is a bridge.
What do you think she means by a gentle bridge? The gentle part is a nice aspect of that. What is she? What do you think
she
means?
Isn't it lovely?
Yeah.
I think she means that it's characterized by compassion and love, and that it's not characterized by, you know, sort of must and should. Mm-hmm. It's characterized by a sense of, you know, sort of invitation and friendship between what is and what could be. That was my sense of it.
So between what is and what could be.
Between what is and what could be. And then I came across an advice columnist in The Guardian. And because, of course, the point of the Hope Project is that you keep your eyes open, not only to what's happening in the world, but to try to find insights and stories and people who might also give you insights about hope. And what I found was that once I kind of tried to deliberately find those stories, I did find them. And I found so many that probably I could have written a book. It was amazing to have this kind of extra. I had so much material, so much material that it couldn't fit into the little 35-minute lecture. But what kind of distilled from it was a series of images. So hope is a gentle bridge, or hope is a bridge. And then from this vice columnist in The Guardian, who was responding to someone who said she felt no joy when she read the news. And the advice columnist said very wisely, I thought, she said, don't focus directly on joy, just focus on looking for a little spark. And this advice columnist used the image of trying to start a fire at a campsite in the rain and being absolutely wet through. And, you know, the point is that you don't have a roaring fire immediately. You just need a spark to kind of start things. And so hope then, you know, could be a spark in the middle of a sodden, dreary, miserable campsite. So those kinds of images start coming. And then in the course of the exploration, then I came to the Psalms. I thought I should maybe look at the biblical witness a little bit in terms of what is the way that the Psalms sort of treat hope. And I found that quite often there's a Hebrew word used for hope. And the word, as I understand it, is tikva, which means rope. And like many Americans have a particular ancestor who comes from the Mayflower. His name is John Howland. And John Howland was kind of the original boy who lived on the Mayflower. I think he was in his teens. He was a servant to somebody else on the Mayflower, and he fell overboard during a storm. And the story goes that he was about 20 feet under the water, and they threw a rope, and he managed somehow in the middle of the storm to feel the rope under the water and to grab onto it and be hauled out. And then he got married and had 12 or 13 kids. So hence there's millions of people who are his descendants. But I do often think of being under that water and somehow seeing the rope and somehow managing to find the rope and somehow kind of holding on to the rope, you know, kind of grabbing it and holding on. And I think that's the sense in which the psalmist is speaking as well of you know, sort of looking in really desperate measures for something to hold on to. And that's the sense in which hope is a rope. And you have that, like recurrent in the Psalms as one image, you know, sort of being basically submerged in drowning, nearly drowning, submerged in mud, and you know, just all of this kind of sense of, you know, basically being overwhelmed by something that threatens one's life.
Tikva being rope, and that combined with the image of the story of the Mayflower, it just gives you that illustration of literally needing that salvation. That's something that we sometimes feel, and the prayers of the Psalms cannot actually offer us a lifeline, that they can offer us a way to see out of where we are. The whole act of noticing hope, as you were saying, you were paying attention not only to what's going on in the world that could cause you to despair, you were paying attention also to hope. And then it, you know, once you find that spark or that bridge or lifeline, then you can move from there. And actually, that's a good segue into the psychological first aid, because part of what happens, I think, when you find these hopeful resources, whether it's the Psalms or something else, is that you find a place of safety, you find a place where you can receive a little bit of healing or find some centeredness within yourself, you know, and then from there you can go on and you can make a good decision about what to do next.
Yeah, absolutely. So in Red Cross, Red Crescent circles, one of the insights that has come out of many years of working as first responders is that the mental good health is a really important component of health. And that's taken a long time to sort of articulate, but the attention to people's mental good health is really important. And one of the approaches that first responders have now incorporated around the world in situations of, you know, really unimaginable sort of dislocation and trauma in places where people are living in camps for displaced people with their lives having been uprooted and so forth, and in places where you're interacting with people who are first responders to earthquake, all those kinds of things, is this idea of psychological first aid. And psychological first aid comprises of a number of elements where you're just trying to, like in the physical first aid, you know, where you're trying to stabilize somebody sufficiently until the paramedics get there. Psychological first aid is kind of the psychological equivalent of that. And what you're trying to do in very simple ways that are accessible to the person and to you as a non, you know, psychologist, are to firstly establish a sense of safety in the place where you are, and then to establish a sense of calm, to try to just pause with the person and to consider then what might be something that they can do to establish a sense of agency. Really important in whatever way possible to think about the agency that's available to that person. It might be that the person can call a family member to say that they're safe, or can think about how to make a good place there for a child or a pet or what have you. So to establish a sense of agency. And then to try to build on that, to establish a sense of connection, and a sense of kind of starting to rebuild those bonds between people, rebuilding community. And then finally, to establish a sense of hope. Without kind of holding out something that's false or glib, but to, within what's possible, to try to show confidence that that you think the person can get through this and can take it a little bit at a time to get to the next place, and to, you know, sort of whatever you can find to sort of establish that there could be something that is better. And so it's about safety, it's about calm, it's about connection, it's about agency, and it's about hope. And I found the insights of the psychological first aid in humanitarian emergencies actually might be helpful to me in terms of my own way of ordering my own sort of devotional life and my own sort of sense of how to move through my days, you know. And so I actually thought then deliberately, how am I trying to establish a sense of safety, a sense of calm, a sense of connection, a sense of agency, and a sense of hope? How am I doing that in my prayer disciplines? And, you know, I came across a wonderful book on mindfulness, which invited me to stop and go one breath deeper. And so sometimes I stop and I think, one breath deeper. And then another time, you know, it encouraged me to think, okay, breathe, find your body, feel your feet. And I love that. BFF, breathe. Feel your body, find your feet. and the other kind of invitation to be where your feet are, which I thought was kind of cool. about a sense of, you know, sort of being in the present moment mm-hmm. and being where you are. And
being grounded.
Yeah. So that psychological first aid has immediate, obvious uses in places where trauma is very immediate. But I think it potentially has some use for our various experiences of collective trauma as well.
How do you think that applies to the collective trauma of the pandemic?
Well, I think increasingly, so much more than in the 90s. I don't think we could have imagined this in the 90s, how disconnected we are, and then how accelerated that has become in the pandemic, when our usual ways of coping with challenges have been cut off to us in terms of, you know, sort of, for example, gathering to support people who are going through a difficult period or a bereavement, you know, and that's been cut off to us. So I feel that perhaps one of the greatest challenges is this challenge about how we build connections. I do believe very much that we're created for community, and we are experiencing a pandemic where we've all been socially isolated and so forth. And we're then on top of that experiencing very accelerated divisions and polarizations that have been amped up by the mechanics of the way the internet and various platforms on the internet work. And so that challenge of connection, real human connection, is a really important component to trying to find our way back, I think, to community. And I think when you have these small connections that you notice, they can be a real source of hope. Just people, when you notice people in person, in real life, being kind to each other, being kind to strangers, mm-hmm. it's you know, sort of a little bit of trying to rebuild those connections.
Great Redeemer.
I think another helpful thing that I came to in kind of trying to revisit old disciplines, old spiritual disciplines, as part of the, you know, the sort of hope as an anchor, think, okay, what are the old spiritual disciplines that might be an anchor for me? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one of the anchors that I found was that actually this old fashioned sense of vocation can be really, really useful and helpful to us. If we feel like we have to do everything, you know what? We don't. We don't have to do everything. We don't have to respond to everything, because each of us has a call to something that is ours to do. And after that, it's up to God. You know, it's like we can turn mm-hmm. over the rest of it to God. Mm-hmm. And so I find both of those things helpful, both the sort of positive sense of pull into a sense of vocation. What is it I'm called to do? What is it I'm uniquely able to do in this situation? And then also the sense of liberation of the fact that actually the rest of it is not mine to do. It's not mine to do. And that's a really old-fashioned idea, this sense of vocation. But I think there's something that we can reclaim from it in terms of trying to navigate our way through things that are, you know, frankly overwhelming in mm-hmm. terms of the quantity and the badness and the direction of the news. The other thing that's kind of a old-fashioned approach that I find helpful in that sort of sense of hope as an anchor is the sense of coming to the end of my own resources and realizing that I'm I'm too small for all this big stuff. And, you know, really kind of, again, this kind of old fashioned sense of kind of handing it back to God and saying, God, this is too much for me. I gotta give this back to you. I don't know what to do with this. And so I think, you know, again, this kind of old fashioned sense of feeling rightly small, against all this big stuff, and saying, okay, I have my thing that I can do, and I'm going to try to do it as best I can. And the rest I have to hand back.
Yeah. Because I think some of what is so difficult about hearing news that's so much bigger than anything we can kind of even comprehend is how small we feel. And yet, I guess you're kind of turning that into something that's actually a grace. You know, I am too small, and therefore it's not for me to handle.
Yes, but it's not all for me to handle. If you couple the sense of vocation with the sense of smallness, you have your thing that is yours to do.
Yeah,
and you have the sense that you can hand back the other stuff.
Yeah.
and feel the sense of peace with it.
Yeah.
But you've got to have the positive sense of vocation, because just handing it back is not is not in itself gonna do much.
That's kind of back to the idea of it's almost like, I'm not paying attention, I'm just gonna put the blinders on.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I see so many people who, for very understandable reasons, would just rather not pay attention at all.
Yeah.
And it's trying to find the things that will help you both pay attention and have hope.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. So what's yours to do? And also, not everything is mine to do.
Yeah.
And it's hard for us to find our sense of vocation when we're overwhelmed and in despair and in disorientation and anxiety. When we're in that stage, it's kind of like we need that psychological first aid. We need to come to that place of safety. And so for some of us, maybe a way to find that sense of safety would be through prayers like the Psalms or music or poetry, things that are grounding, things that are, you know, that help us to find that center. And then beyond that is this idea of sort of, well, what can I do?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what is mine to do?
What is mine to do? And how do you figure that out?
With difficulty, I think. But not impossible. I mean, I think that's such a good question. I'm only pausing because I feel a sense of my answer, but I don't know how to tell somebody else how to find their answer.
Well, maybe if you share your answer, it'll help others.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I keep a journal most mornings, and I try to do gratitude and intercessions and then intention. And so the intercessions set out, you know, the messiness and the things that are sort of top of mind, or all the mess and all the hard things, whether they're, you know, kind of right in my personal circle or whether they're further afield. And the intention, I think, kind of then focuses on what's my way of being in the world today. What am I going to try to do today in the world? So it's just one day at a time, really. But that helps me.
That's a really good formula. I haven't heard that before. Those three things: gratitude, intercessions, and intentions. I think the intercessions part is interesting, because, yeah, say more about that one. Intercession. So is that sort of where you process what you're hearing about what's going on in the world, or, you know, things that are maybe burdening you, like that feel sort of heavy on you, and you're sorting through them?
Well, I think that intercessory prayer is so important if you want to pay attention and not lose hope, because you can take the stuff that you're reading about on online or wherever, or hearing about, and basically sometimes say, you know, I don't know how to pray about this except for to name what I understand. You know, sometimes people tell me of situations where their friends are prisoners of conscience, or they have heard of fellow students who've been arrested and are in jail, or various stories where I imagine people are in places that are pretty hopeless. And I think the intercessions allows you to expand your imagination a little bit into some pretty desperate and difficult places. But in a way that is saying, you know, kind of imagining that God is seeing those places. So it's not just you imagining them, but it's imagining them in this whole big, messy world that God loves so much, and somehow kind of bringing yourself into the picture of that, you know, difficult situation. So then the kind of expansion of your imagination and kind of imagining how God sees this world that God loves so much, and all the different dark and horrible and difficult places, and where people are dealing with being sick and alone, and all of these different hard things that are happening in the pandemic. It then helps you focus your intention in terms of whether you will respond to that directly, or whether you will just try to do something else in your work that's ahead of you. I think intercession is really important in terms of the spiritual imagination and drawing us into God's will for the world.
Yeah. Gosh, that's a beautiful way of thinking of intercessions, expanding your imagination to imagine God loving all of this, all of the brokenness, all of the messiness, all of the pain and the suffering, but that God is with all of that, but also loving. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Psalms for the Spirit, produced by myself, Kieran Young-Wimberly, with music by Celtic Psalms. On my website, kieranyoungwimberly.com, you'll find links to what I'm up to and opportunities to connect. Till next time, may our spirits find healing and hope in the days ahead.
Come, Spirit, come, rescue us, we pray. Shield us and save us, and come down to stay.